Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, July 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sierra Leone's opposition APC will not participate on any level of governance.
It's not a blanket abdication of the will of the people. In fact, what we want is for the will of the people to be honored. And for that to happen, we need the results to be made available in accordance with this legislation on the Public Elections Act.
Activists react to the withdrawal of the UN peacekeeping mission from Mali. Fierce fighting erupted Sunday between Sudan's rival forces as analysts consider an internationally supported peacekeeping force. Some perceived instability within the royal family of South Africa's Zulu ethnic group. Britain issues a terror alert for Uganda.
They must have some information pointing to threats to their interests or their citizens. But whatever it is cannot be surprising.
And Botswana and De Beers extend a diamond sales agreement after lengthy negotiations. The stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Results from Sierra Leone's June 24 election have been announced. The ruling Sierra Leone People's Party, the SLPP, has won the presidency and the majority in parliament, 81 seats, against the opposition All People's Congress, the APC party, with 54 seats. However, the APC has rejected the results and says it will not participate on any level of governance. That's because it says the government tampered with the results to hand itself the majority. In a statement released over the weekend, the APC also called for a rerun of the elections within 6 months to be overseen by what the party calls credible individuals and institutions. It also called for the resignation of the Electoral Commission chair and the heads of the police and army. Yvonne Aki-Sawyer is the APC's re-elected mayor of the capital city, Freetown. She tells me that the party wants the poll results to represent the will of the people.
It's not a blanket abdication of the will of the people. In fact, what we want is for the will of the people to be honored. And for that to happen, we need the results to be made available in accordance with this legislation on the Public Elections Act. We need the results to be made available to everyone at the polling station level. We need to see what the numbers were that were input by the Electoral Commission and compare that to what all the other parties have in their results and reconciliations forms. From my own mayoral position, I have the RRF forms, and with 85% of those, I am at 66.5% of the valid votes. This is in contrast to what was reported by the Electoral Commission, who said that with 94% of the valid votes, I was at 51%. There is no way those two numbers add up. So what the party is asking for is let us, in accordance with the law, see the numbers that you put input. We need the results disaggregated at polling station level.
So what happens now in terms of governance of Freetown?
We've made our position known to the government. As I said, the request is a very simple one. This is an election. When there's an election and people vote, we expect to see the results of those votes reflected. We don't think we're asking for something that's arduous or onerous. The RRF forms that the Electoral Commission used to arrive at their results should be made available to us, as has been the case in every election prior to date. So that's where we are. This is our request, and we don't think it's a difficult one. It's the same request that's been made by the EU Observer Mission. The same request has been made by the Commonwealth. The same request has been made by ECOWAS. The same request has been made in the Joint Statement of Development Partners. The same request has been made by the African Union in their communique. This is not an unusual request.
Mayor, we thank you very much again, and congratulations, as I said.
Thank you.
Yvonne Aki-Sawyer is the APC re-elected mayor of Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown. She was speaking with us from Freetown. The UN Security Council voted unanimously to end the mandate of the UN peacekeeping mission to Mali, also known as MINUSMA, after the military government demanded it withdraw. MINUSMA controls many of the airports and the cities in Mali's troubled north since the French army's withdrawal last year. Activists and analysts say the withdrawal will leave a big gap in security as Mali struggles against Islamist militants. Anne Risenberg reports from Bamako.
The results of the vote were announced at a UN Security Council meeting Friday. The vote follows comments from Mali's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Abdoulaye Diop, at a Security Council meeting earlier this month asking for MINUSMA to withdraw immediately. His statements were followed by an official press release from the Malian government asking MINUSMA to leave. Anassa Ahamadou Maiga, a resident of Mali's northern city of Gao and an active member of the city's civil society groups, makes frequent trips to Bamako. Like much of the country, Maiga depends on MINUSMA flights to move around inside Mali's borders. The roads between the southern capital, Bamako, and the northern cities are fraught with violence. From a nearly empty restaurant in Bamako Friday, Maiga said that in addition to the security concerns, much of the north depends on MINUSMA for basic services, and it is one of the biggest employers in Gao. He fears the young people who work for MINUSMA will be left without support after the withdrawal. He says this will play on the social, economic, and security situation. If we leave the youth abandoned like that, there is a terrorist threat too. Terrorists pay their combatants, he says. Maiga is due to return to Gao on a MINUSMA flight in a few days and is not sure if he will be able to return to Bamako once MINUSMA flights are stopped. Batraore, a Sahel researcher at Wathi, a Dakar, Senegal-based think tank, said via a messaging application the MINUSMA withdrawal may trigger security issues. He says the presence of MINUSMA is firstly dissuasive. The withdrawal could leave a security void, he says, but he believes it's too early to say what will happen because the government has not said what its plan is for when MINUSMA leaves. Chaudhry also echoed Maiga's concerns about the social and economic implications of the withdrawal. Andrew Leibovich, a research fellow at the Klingendahl Institute's Conflict Research Unit, speaking from Washington via a messaging application, said the withdrawal is likely to affect the 2015 Algiers peace agreement between the government and a coalition of rebel groups, the CSP.
It also poses a real risk for the peace process. The CSP, the signatory armed groups, have already said in a statement that they consider the peace accord essentially to be finished if MINUSMA leaves.
MINUSMA was first established in Mali in 2013 after the French army retook northern Mali following an Islamist takeover in 2012. French forces withdrew from Mali last year following months of increasing tensions with the military government. Mali has been under military rule since a 2020 coup, and MINUSMA has also seen increasing tensions with the government under military rule, with the government prohibiting them from carrying out air operations and from carrying out investigations of human rights abuses. The Human Rights Division of MINUSMA was denied access to the site of a massacre in Moura, Mali last year that was allegedly carried out by government forces working with Russian Wagner mercenaries. The UN did investigate the Moura massacre via interviews with witnesses and published a report in May. The Malian government then accused the UN of spying. The Security Council resolution includes a six-month withdrawal period for MINUSMA. Annie Risenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Fierce fighting between the forces of rival generals shook the Sudanese capital Khartoum on Sunday as disease and malnutrition threatened the rising number of displaced. According to the French news agency AFP, a Khartoum resident said he was shaken from sleep by violent fighting in which various weapons were used. Analysts monitoring Sudan say it might take an internationally supported peacekeeping force to end the ongoing fighting there. That assessment follows multiple failed ceasefire attempts and talks facilitated by Saudi Arabia and the United States. VOA's Mariama Diallo has this story.
Until 2 weeks ago, Hala Al-Karib was living in Khartoum. She's the regional director of the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa. She and other colleagues have had to relocate because of the war within and outside Sudan. Among all the horrors of war, she and others also have had to deal with looting.
I would say more or less, 75% or more of Khartoum inhabitants, they have experienced lootings. Our homes were completely looted, destroyed and burned.
She says the strategy for the rapid support forces run by General Hamdan Dagalo is not new.
The presence on the ground, inside residential areas, being in Khartoum or being in Al Fasher or being in Niala or what happened in Junaina, that is if strategy is to run a war, you know, from within and inside civilians' residency. Of course, the RSF are the extension of the Janjaweed.
As for the Sudanese armed forces led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, Al-Karib says they enabled the RSF to flourish.
SAF, unfortunately, you know, they were for years, you know, kind of, you know, relying on the RSF to do the dirty work. And they were complacent and enabled, you know, these criminal organizations to grow. And right now it grew to the point that, you know, it's not a risk against them, but it actually threatened the existence of overall Sudan as a state.
She says it's unfortunate the international community is not exerting sufficient pressure on countries that could help end the war.
75% of the causes of this war lies outside of Sudan. UAE, definitely, and their significant support to the RSF, Egypt and their positions anti any type of democratic governance in Sudan.
A sentiment partly echoed by Dr. Edgar Githua, a lecturer at the United States International University and Strathmore University.
The African Union and the world in general, looking at this situation, needs to, you know, step up, need to actually just call out Russia, tell Russia, pull out the Wagner group, get it out. Egypt, I think it's an easier group to deal with. The US has a lot of leverage with Egypt. Libya, Hafiz Khalifa can be told to back down also. And the UAE can be told to back off.
Some of the countries mentioned offered to mediate the crisis and denied involvement in the war. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, July 3rd. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. In Uganda, four-time presidential candidate and current leader of the People's Front for Transition, Dr. Kizza Besigye, says while he does not know what specific intelligence led the British government to issue a terror alert for Uganda, he is not surprised by the decision. According to Sunday's Uganda Monitor, the alert predicts that the attacks could be indiscriminate or against foreign nationals or places frequented by them. Dr. Besigye tells me he is not surprised by the warning because Uganda has had a considerable number of terror attacks in recent years.
I cannot tell what specific information informed the British to issue the alert at this particular time. They must have some information pointing to threats to their interests or their citizens. But whatever it is cannot be surprising, considering that in the last couple of years, we've had a significant number of terror attacks, largely attributable to a rebel group of Ugandans that are mainly operating out of the neighboring country of the Democratic Republic of Congo. So there is a general threat that hangs over the country. I think this is a new twist that there is a specific threat to the British in Uganda.
Although the British advisory did not say exactly the threat level, but what do you make of the comment attributed to President Museveni's deputy press secretary, Farouk Chirunda? He says that the advisory by the UK government to its citizens is noted. But he said, Uganda is not at war and our security forces are there to ensure safety and security of citizens and our visitors.
Quite clearly ridiculous, because certainly Uganda is at war. As I have told you, for the last 2 years, a large contingent, this is something like two brigades, are operating outside Uganda, in the neighboring areas of Uganda, fighting actively what is believed to be rebel forces of the ADF. Secondly, you know that Uganda has been also fighting actively in Somalia against the Al-Shabaab.
Dr. Kizza Besigye is a four-time Uganda presidential candidate and the current leader of the People's Front for Transition. He was speaking with us from Geneva, Switzerland. A South African political analyst says the current perceived instability within the royal family of the Zulu ethnic group or nation is manifested in the ongoing quarrel over who should be king. This comes as there were reports on Sunday of uncertainty over the health of King Mrs. Zulu Zulu, who assumed the throne last year. Professor Sipho Sipe is the former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He tells me that what is happening now borders on paranoia or being overly cautious given the history of finding a successor to a Zulu king.
Well, I mean, at the moment, things are not very clear because you have two contradictory reports. The prime minister in the office of the king of the Zulus, Mangosuthu Buthelezi, gave out a statement that indicated that the king is unwell. And that he also took that after one of his advisors died. And the suggestion is that there was a poisoning. So according to the Prime Minister, Chief Buthelezi, the king was rushed to Eswatini, where he would be safe because the king of Eswatini is his uncle. And the fear was that there might be a possibility that he could be poisoned. And given that his mother also died in hospital in South Africa, there was a sense that South Africa may not be a safe place. I mean, there's a statement coming from Buthelezi. But what the king's spokesperson had said had almost not suggested that it is not true, but to suggest that the king's unwellness is exaggerated. But one must also understand that it is not only about the issue of being unsafe. The tensions between the family still exist because in Zulu tradition, the position of a successor to the king is always contested, especially when the departed king has a number of children.
Professor, I'd like to ask you, is what is going on, is it paranoia or this? I mean, there's truth to all this. Is it paranoia?
I think the paranoia is at the level of unwellness. It is not clear whether, because the king feels unwell, whether that, given the fact that there's still not yet stability within the royal family, the people are taking precautionary measures to say it could be part of the ongoing battles, especially when the advisor to the king has reportedly died of poisoning. So that is more about taking precautionary measures. But also what one must understand is that the position of the king of the Zulus has always been contested. Even the previous king, before he ascended the throne, he had to be put elsewhere for safety before he could be presented to the Zulu nation to say he is now the king who would be reigning over the Zulu nation. So the contestation within the royal family is not unusual. And the stories are that people die in the process as people try to ascend the throne. So all these things create an environment where people become overcautious or paranoid.
Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst and former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. Botswana and the London-based International Diamond Consortium, De Beers, have ended uncertainty over their long-standing partnership after announcing a 10-year extension to their diamond sales agreement. Mkundise Dube reports from Habaroni.
In a joint statement released late Friday, Botswana and De Beers indicated their sales agreement has been extended until 2034, while the mining license will be in place for the next 25 years. No value was given for the agreement, and there were no further details on the allocation of rough stones. But the government and De Beers say the new deal reflects the aspirations of the people of Botswana. Addressing the media this week, Botswana's Minerals Minister, Lefoko Moahi, indicated a deal was imminent and that it would be a favorable situation for both parties.
We are making headway. We are very optimistic that We all are fully aware of what it means to Botswana, what it means to DPS, what it means to the diamond industry. So we believe that we will gravitate towards something that will be a shared win, if not a win-win for all of us.
Botswana's President Mokgweetsi Masisi held a firm position during the negotiations, saying his country was prepared to walk away if a favorable deal were not reached. Under the previous arrangement, Botswana was allocated 25% of rough diamonds mined through Debswana, a joint venture between the government and De Beers. Last year, De Beers obtained 70% of its rough diamonds from Botswana. Diamond mining contributes approximately one-third of Botswana's gross domestic product and is a major factor in the Southern African nation's rise as the sixth richest country on the continent. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in South Africa, where South Africa's Women's World Cup preparations were plunged into chaos on Sunday when a shadow national team, including a 13-year-old, took on Botswana in a friendly as the squad selected for the finals were locked in a dispute with the National Association. The match was supposed to be a send-off for the squad going to the World Cup in Australia and New Zealand before they continue their preparations outside the country. But a dispute with the South African Football Association over bonus payments and their contracts for the tournament meant the World Cup-bound squad did not play. Instead, a hastily put-together side with no senior national team experience lost 5-0 in front of a bemused fans at a packed Sakane Stadium and a watching television audience. As part of resolving the dispute, Gauteng Premier Panyanza Lesufi brought together Banyana Banyana captain, the Football Association and the South African Player Union leadership, where the parties agreed to go back to the negotiation table for further consultations.
That all parties agree to a cease of hostilities, that from now on everyone will go back to the negotiating table. There will be no need for screaming, shouting, the embarrassment that will come through.
Staying with football news, the semi-finalists in the CAF Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations 2023 have emerged. Host Morocco and Guinea emerged as the qualifiers from Group A, where the teams played their games in Rabat, while defending champions Egypt and Mali secured their spots from Group B, having played their games in Tangier. Egypt will now face Guinea in the first semi-final clash on Tuesday in Tangier, while Morocco, who finished atop Group A with an impressive 9 points, will go head-to-head against Mali. In addition to vying for the tournament trophy, the teams are also in pursuit of the three available slots for Africa in the 2024 Olympic Games in Paris next year. And on to athletics, Robert Kipkemboi and Naomi Jebet are the winners of the second edition of the Nairobi City Marathon that was held on Sunday. Kipkemboi won the men's race in 2 hours, 8 minutes, 30 seconds to beat into second place Yossi Minera, who was running his second marathon, while Robert Kipkori came in third. Naomi Jebet won the women's marathon gold in 2 hours, 24 minutes, 33 seconds, her first marathon win, followed by Sharon Chilemo, who came in second in 2 hours, 25 minutes, 20 seconds. And Judith Jeruth took the third spot in 2 hours, 27 minutes, 01 seconds. Staying with athletics and still in Kenya, Athletics Kenya has announced that some 160 athletes will compete at the Athletics Kenya trials that will be held on July 7th to the 8th. At the Nyanyo Stadium. The Federation will use a two-day event to pick a team that will fly the Kenyan flag in this year's World Championships, slated for August 19th to the 27th in Budapest, Hungary. And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, July 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Butter in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.